Hello there. Today is Wednesday, October 23rd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, Syrians vacate border towns as the ceasefire expires and nervous locals who remain fear the worst.
They feel like they have been abandoned and left through the slaughter, and that's how they describe it.
The top U.S. diplomat to Ukraine paints a damning picture of the president's actions that led to an impeachment inquiry. Also ahead, another contentious day in the U.K. as the British Parliament continues to struggle with plans for its exit from the EU. It's all on today's International Edition. President Donald Trump triggered outrage Tuesday by comparing the Democratic-led impeachment inquiry to a lynching. AP correspondent Shelley Adler reports.
I wish I could say we were shocked.
Leisha Brooks, the outreach director with the Southern Poverty Law Center.
The president often uses inflammatory words to describe the troubles that he finds himself in, but this is particularly offensive.
To the White House and another interpretation with spokesman Hogan Gidley.
He's not comparing himself to those dark times. Let's be very clear about what he's doing. He is receiving zero due process from Democrats on the Hill. That's what he's talking about. It's very clear.
Shelley Adler, Washington.
Meanwhile, the top American diplomat in Ukraine testified Tuesday on Capitol Hill that President Trump made the release of U.S. security aid to Ukraine contingent on Kiev publicly declaring it would carry out politically motivated investigations that he demanded. The comments by William Taylor, a career diplomat and former Army officer, detailed numerous conversations and events and emphasized the strategic importance of Ukraine as it faces Russian aggression. Congressman Eric Swalwell, who sits on the House Intelligence and Judiciary Committee, says published reports about former U.S. Ambassador Bill Taylor's testimony are accurate.
What has been printed, that describes more evidence of a direct connection between President Trump's wishes that Ukraine investigate the 2016 election, essentially exonerating the Russians, and his potential 2020 opponent, Vice President Biden and his family, in exchange for President Zelensky in Ukraine to get a White House meeting and security assistance.
Taylor's statement to the three Democratic-led House of Representative committees leading an impeachment inquiry against the president marked a pivotal development in the political drama unfolding in Washington that is threatening Trump's presidency even as he pursues re-election. And it ran counter to Trump's contention that there was no quid pro quo, a Latin phrase meaning a favor for a favor, related to the $391 million in security assistance approved by Congress to help combat Russian-backed separatists in eastern Ukraine that Trump had been withholding. Joining us to talk more about all of it in detail is Robert Deitz, professor of governmental affairs at George Mason University Schar School of Policy and Government. How damning was Tuesday's closed-door testimony as far as what we are hearing?
I do. And let me tell you why I think it's damning. Mr. Taylor is an old-school diplomat. And what I mean by that is, if you see, particularly the old-school guys, I'm not sure what it's like now, if you look at the old-style men and women in the Foreign Service, they always carry around a notebook that's only about 3.5 inches wide, so it fits inside a coat pocket. As soon as they're in a meeting, they take the thing out and start taking notes. And what struck me about Mr. Taylor is that apparently, you know, again, of course, I wasn't there, but apparently he has detailed notes that had times and dates of every phone call involved in this and with details explaining what was said by whom. There are a couple of things that are interesting about that. For those people who complain about, oh, this is all hearsay, actually, that's not hearsay. That's admissible evidence in a court.
What stood out the most for you as far as his testimony of what we know?
It wasn't just one phone call that concerned him. It was clear from his testimony that there was a concerted effort over time by the Trump administration to create a quid pro quo. That is, we're not going to give you the $400 million or so until, and this was new, there had to be a sort of a declaration in the public square, as it were, that the Ukrainian authorities were investigating the Bidens. But in addition, they had to investigate the 2016 election. As you know, Mr. Trump has this notion that there is a missing server taken to the Ukraine that has details about Secretary of State Clinton's emails.
So basically what you're saying is that not only did he testify that they were withholding the military aid until Ukraine promised to investigate these two basically political rivals,
yes,
Joe Biden and Hillary Clinton, but also that it had to be that they had to announce it publicly? Is
they
that
had to
saying?
Announce it publicly, yes. That may have been implicit in earlier testimony, but this is the first time where it was where there was testimony to that effect. And again, backed up by detailed notes that Mr. Taylor had created over the last number of months.
Would you say that that makes it worse that they wanted them to announce it publicly in their, as the Trump administration says, fight corruption?
Yeah, it does make it worse. And the reason it makes it worse is if I demand that somebody be investigated for corruption, people immediately say, what? Is there evidence of that? So by announcing in the public square the Ukrainian government is going to investigate the Bidens, in people's minds in the United States and no doubt elsewhere are going to say, gee, I didn't know there was corruption by the Bidens. I better look into that. So yes, by announcing it publicly, it makes it sound more serious. And in addition, the Ukrainian officials end up owning the issue. In other words, it's not just Mr. Trump claiming it. Mm. It's the Ukrainians claiming it as well.
Right.
And that does make it worse, yes.
And, you know, we look back on Hillary Clinton's campaign right before the actual election when then FBI Director James Comey came out and said they were reopening an investigation,
yes,
into Clinton's emails. And then a few days later, he said, never mind, basically.
Yes.
And that hurt her. So I would imagine that would be part of it, too, that when you say something that hasn't been proven or that you're investigating someone for something like that, that's a political rival, it would tend to hurt them.
Absolutely. It's devastating because, again, serious officials such as the FBI senior leadership don't announce investigations unless there's something there. You know, citing the old saying that my mother used to use, where there's smoke, there's fire. So you're effectively saying, well, there's some smoke here, and people are going to come to the conclusion, oh, then there must be some corruption.
All right, that's Robert Deitz. He's professor of governmental affairs at George Mason University's Schar School of Policy and Government. Cities and towns along the border in northeastern Syria evacuated in the final hours of their ceasefire with Turkey Tuesday. Syrian and Russian forces will deploy in northeast Syria to remove Kurdish fighters and their weapons from the border with Turkey under a deal agreed on Tuesday, which both Moscow and Ankara hailed as a triumph. VOA's Heather Murdoch talked about it with International Edition's Steve Miller and discussed what she is seeing on the ground from northern Syria.
Well, we've been driving through the countryside so far, so it's pretty quiet here. But we have heard a lot of people talking about what's been happening in the past couple of days. As you may know, yesterday, the government of Bashar al-Assad made a deal with the administration of the Kurdish region to take over some of the security. Basically, to the people, though, it appeared like the regime was coming in and taking over areas, and nobody knew exactly what that meant. Even we talked to Kurdish soldiers off the record, even though they have a deal in place now, they say that the regime says they are just helping out militarily, guarding borders, and will not take over the cities. They've been told that, but they're really not trusting it that much. So people are nervous about it, but they're also a little relieved that so far it hasn't happened. So far, like, I'm here. I'm under a permit from Kurdish authorities. And the fact that I'm here at all means that the regime is not trying to take over this area entirely right now, which has been semi-autonomous for a long time.
And what's been their reaction overall to the events that have been taking place since last week?
It's actually just been, I mean, it can't be described any other way as total chaos. Roads are cut, like half of this area is cut off from each other. One of the major cities, Kobani, the road to that, is now held by Syrian rebels that are backed by Turkey. So people can't get in or out of that area without driving through a road that is well known to be a home to many sleeper cells of Islamic State. And because of the fact that everyone here expects there's a possibility of Islamic State militants escaping from prisons, already families of Islamic State militants have escaped from camps that were closed and they were locked inside. So nobody's trusting the roads where the sleeper cells have been making attacks for since ISIS lost their territory last year. They're still fighting in the border town. Some soldiers today told us in one border town, one key strategic town that Turkey has been bombing since it began, the Syrian Democratic Forces often take it over at night, only to be defeated again the next morning.
There's been widespread concern about a looming humanitarian crisis as the conflict goes on. What have you been able to see and piece together as you speak together with individuals there about that possibility?
Well, I think in a lot of sense it's already happening, and we're also a little bit limited in our mobility at the moment because there's so much fighting and there's no clear front line. So far as we know, hundreds of people have been killed, including some reporters. One aspect of the humanitarian crisis that's hard to put our finger on is that there's a large refugee camp of 14,000 people that security left, and most of them just left, including 700 or 800 people that were relatives of ISIS, most of them foreigners.
When the decision to pull American troops out last week was made, the Syrian Democratic Force spokesman said that he analogized it to America stabbing the Kurds in the back. When you're out speaking to people in the area, have they mentioned anything about their perception of the events?
That they feel stabbed in the back is ubiquitous. Everyone says that, especially as I introduce myself as a reporter for Voice of America. They say, America. And while they haven't shown hostility towards me, they are angry at Donald Trump for making this decision and lay the blame squarely on the President of the United States. They feel like they have been allies for a long time. They feel like they have been abandoned and left to the slaughter. And that's how they describe it. One of my friends said, why would Donald Trump want our heads to be cut off? It's very negative and very angry and very sad. They're also very disappointed.
Well, joining us now to talk more about this and get analysis and what this means for the United States is Jamil Jaffer, founder and CEO of the National Security Institute. What's your reaction to all of it?
It's obviously a big deal that there's a deal now in Syria with the Turks and the Russians. But obviously, this is a direct result of the U.S. not playing a central role in this effort. We were the ones who went in there, who worked with the Kurds to defeat ISIS. They actually did all the work. We provided them support. And now Russia has the upper hand. They're the ones running the operation there. They're the ones negotiating with Turkey. They're the ones helping our allies, or at least protecting them now from being murdered by the Turks. I mean, it is a ridiculous situation, complete collapse of U.S. leadership in the region. Leadership, by the way, that we have lost thousands or hundreds of lives in order to obtain, and that we hand over to Russia at our own peril. And by the way, let's not forget that the Russians are aligned with the Syrians, who are aligned with the Iranians. So now you have an agreement between essentially Iran, Syria, Russia, and Turkey, none of which cuts in the U.S.'s favor.
What does that mean as far as U.S. national security?
It's nothing good. It's empowered Russia to be a much bigger player in the Middle East. It's empowered Iran because they're client state Syria has now solidified its hold on power. ISIS is empowered by the Kurds having to pull back, and it is highly unlikely that the Turks or the Russians are going to do nearly as good a job as our allies in protecting the territory from ISIS. And frankly, the Russians don't have our best interests at heart. And so the fact that we've given them the initiative here is a mistake for U.S. national security, and in the long run will be bad for U.S. policy in the region.
As you said, the Russians, the Iranians, Turkey. Why would the president do something that would benefit all of these autocratic leaders more than what all his advisors here in the United States are saying could be a potential disaster, which seems to be unfolding?
Well, look, the president has a very single-minded perspective on the Middle East question. And it's frankly a perspective that he shared with President Obama, which is that we have to end our involvement in these so-called endless wars. We need to get out of the Middle East. We need to turn our attention, as the president has, to focusing on our strategic challenge and relationship with China, and that the Middle East is a fight that somebody else should be involved in. And frankly, the mainstream of America recognizes that our involvement in Syria, particularly against ISIS, is highly important to ensure that we are protected from the threat of terrorism. Now, it is true that the American public is tired of the war in Afghanistan and was tired of the war in Iraq. That doesn't mean it was in our strategic interest today to retreat from either of those conflicts, given that we have a choice. We can either fight our enemies on their soil overseas, or we can fight them here at home. We recognize what happened when the Soviets left Afghanistan previously. We saw the rise of the Taliban and the safe haven for Osama bin Laden. We saw what happened when, under President Obama, we withdrew precipitously from Iraq, the rise and success of ISIS. And I predict we will see the same results now that we've handed over responsibility for the region to actors who don't have our interests at stake, including Iran, who supports the terrorist group Hezbollah, Syria, which has massacred its own people, Russia, which tried to go after our elections, and Turkey, which is frankly run by a very aggressive, while democratically elected, essentially a dictator.
We did this so abruptly that it's had a pretty intense impact on the Kurds, who have thought that we were their allies. There is a humanitarian crisis brewing. We're hearing of children that are like traumatized and needing mental health care. You know, all these people have no more home to go back to. What does it say? As you mentioned, our allies, will they be there for us if we need them, if our word is no longer good?
Well, that's a huge concern, right? I remember the president talks a lot about how the U.S. defeated ISIS. But let's be clear. We defeated ISIS on the backs of our Kurdish allies. We fired hardly a shot in anger in that conflict other than airstrikes. Almost all the work on the ground and almost all the lives that were lost on the ground were lost by Kurdish soldiers and Syrian Democratic Forces, primarily made up of Kurdish soldiers, acting on our behalf to fight ISIS. That's how we won the war. Now, having abandoned them to a U.S.-armed NATO ally, Turkey, it's unlikely they're going to look to us for support again, and it's more likely than not that our allies will be less likely to look to us for support. So we have a situation here where we've empowered our enemies, Iran and Russia, and we've undermined the confidence of our allies in the Kurds. That is not a good situation for the United States to be in. It wasn't a good situation when we did it in Iraq with our precipitous withdrawal by President Obama, and it's not good when President Trump does it either.
In the unlikely event that the president would reverse his decision, put U.S. troops back where they were to assist the Kurds, would that stop this, or is this too far gone to reverse course?
No, look, I think that the reason the Turkish forces didn't come across the border and haven't for years, they've wanted to pursue the Kurds for years. Turks wanted to come after the Kurds and attack them and kill them and create a safe zone so that Turkey didn't have Kurdish incursions on the border. Remember, there have been long conflicts between the Kurds who'd like to create their own state and the Turkish government. This is a long-running conflict. It's been going on for decades. And so the Turks have always been uncomfortable with the Kurds having significant control of land. And by empowering them in the fight against ISIS, we allow them to hold more territory. And that's always made the Turks uncomfortable. And so the Turks have always wanted to come across the border, pursue the Kurds, push them out of that region, create a safe zone, right? Now, the problem for us is that having now freed them up to do that, it's very hard to reverse that situation. Nonetheless, the Kurds are not going to really be willing to potentially incur U.S. casualties, and particularly if they think the U.S. would respond. And so if the U.S. were to say, we're going back in, and we will respond if you come after us, or you come after our allies, the Turks would pull back. They've never wanted a conflict with the United States. And so a lot of people have been saying, well, the Turks were already coming across the border. We just got out of the way. Completely false. The Turks have been wanting to come across the border for the better part of a decade. They haven't because we were there in the most recent instances. And prior to that, they knew that we would defend the Kurds if they came across the border. So the bottom line is that the reason they came across the border is because we moved those 50 handful of troops out of the way, giving them the room to walk in.
All right. That's Jamil Jaffer. He's the founder and CEO of the National Security Institute. Thanks for being with us. Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. The U.S. will ask NATO to pay more to protect Saudi Arabia from Iran. Syrian chaos is breathing new life into the Islamic State group. Does the pink tax force women to pay more than men? And calling someone an illegal alien in New York City can result in a serious fine. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com. and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. British lawmakers Tuesday rejected Prime Minister Boris Johnson's call for expedited approval of his plan to divorce the country from the European Union by the end of October. The House of Commons adopted Johnson's 115-page withdrawal agreement bill, the first time Parliament voted in favor of any Brexit proposal, but the lawmakers then snubbed his bid to give final approval to the measure within 3 days, likely eliminating his hope to complete Britain's long-delayed departure from the continent's 28-member bloc by next week.
Mr. Speaker, I must express my disappointment that the House has again voted for delay, rather than a timetable that would have guaranteed that the UK would be in a position to leave the EU on October the 31st with a deal.
But opposition leader Jeremy Corbyn said they will not be bullied into a rushed decision.
Tonight, the House has refused to be bounced into debating a hugely significant piece of legislation in just 2 days, with barely any notice and an analysis of the economic impact of this bill.
The EU is considering whether to grant Britain another three-month delay to the end of January to devise a Brexit plan that contentious lawmakers in London would approve. And in Canada, Liberal icon Justin Trudeau holds on to his government. AP correspondent Mike Gracia reports.
Voters in Canada appeared to give Prime Minister Justin Trudeau a second term in parliamentary elections Monday. Trudeau's Liberal Party was projected to win the most seats in the 338-seat parliament, staving off a serious challenge from rival Conservatives. The choice Canadians faced was between Trudeau and Conservatives leader Andrew Scheer. Trudeau's prospects had been clouded by questions of judgment. Trudeau repeatedly apologized after old photos of him in blackface and brownface had surfaced last month. Months before, his former Attorney General asserted Trudeau had pressured her to halt the prosecution of a Quebec company. I'm Mike Gracia.
And you're listening to International Edition. Back in a moment.
Hello, Africa. I'm James Butte, host of VOA's Daybreak Africa. When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you the news as it happens. Listen to Daybreak Africa Monday through Friday at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC. And our 5-minute newscast come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
VOA's International Edition continues. Tamalewood, a well-loved dish in Mexico with a taste of Hollywood, is what the locals of Albuquerque, New Mexico in the U.S. affectionately call the exploding TV and film industry. There, it has gained ground since enticing tax incentives for filming in New Mexico have led to billion-dollar deals between leading production companies and Albuquerque studios. VOA's Penelope Pulu has more from the high desert of New Mexico.
If you look over to your left, you're going to see the corner house. That is Ted Benigy's house, used on Breaking Bad.
Another day at the office for Frank Sandoval, owner of the Breaking Bad RV Tours in Albuquerque, New Mexico.
How many people freaked out in that scene?
For 3 hours, tourists get to ride on his 1986 Fleetwood Bounder RV, identical to the one featured in the TV series Breaking Bad. The Emmy-winning TV series about a struggling chemistry teacher turned meth drug lord was filmed in Albuquerque and became a hit both domestically and internationally.
Breaking Bad really did put Albuquerque on the map in terms of the film industry.
Here, in an open landscape where sunshine reigns supreme for 310 days a year and the longest traffic commute is 20 minutes, Netflix has put down roots. The entertainment giant purchased Albuquerque Studios, a 100,000-square-foot compound, and signed a billion-dollar deal to produce TV series and movies here over the next 10 years. NBC Universal followed with a $500 million deal.
I'm terribly sorry about your sister.
Thank you. She was a pretty good cop.
Its highly touted TV show, Briar Patch, is one of a dozen TV series filmed in one of the studio's imposing stages in complete secrecy. Briar Patch producers Keith Raskin and Linda Morrell say New Mexico offers a great filming alternative to congested and expensive Los Angeles. The varied landscape and local crew availability won't hurt either. Another major draw?
Space. We've been working in LA for a long time. Obviously, I'm from there. It is very, very difficult to find stage space in Los Angeles right now.
Keith Raskin says all these benefits have become the talk of the town among LA producers gearing up to take their businesses to Albuquerque.
I think we're at the beginning of a tidal wave. There's been a big interest in shooting here.
Hollywood's interest peaked after additional robust tax incentives were signed by New Mexico last July, says Amber Dodson, Albuquerque's film liaison.
The rebate cap was previously at $50 million. It is now raised to $110 million.
The larger the amount a production company invests here, the larger the rebate. New Mexico wins as well, says Dodson. To get the incentive, production companies have to hire local talent.
They are here for 10 years, no matter what. And the amount of jobs, and it's a conservative estimate, that just that deal alone will create is 1,000.
1,000 jobs a year, that is.
We're busier than ever.
Frank Sandoval couldn't agree more. His tour, operating twice a day, is fully booked by people who visit from all over the world.
And then during Breaking Bad, what was the name of the car wash?
So what I see coming down the pike is we're going to become the next Hollywood. And as some people call it, Tamalewood.
Penelope Pulu, VOA News, Albuquerque, New Mexico.
Led Zeppelin II, the second LP of the 70s classic rock sensation Led Zeppelin, is celebrating its release 50 years ago on October 22, 1969. The nine-song set was compiled along the road of a major tour through Europe and North America. Their music was cutting edge and ultimately skyrocketed lead guitarist Jimmy Page, vocalist Robert Plant, bassist John Paul Jones, and drummer John Bonham into fame that made them music icons. And that would also go on to inspire other rock artists from then, continuing to this day. You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for our show today, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. We thank you so much for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Carl Starling. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have yourself a wonderful day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States Agency for International Development and the Interim Government of Venezuela recently signed a development objective agreement. This agreement is the first step in formalizing USAID development assistance for the legitimate government of Venezuela, which is led by Interim President Juan Guaido and the National Assembly. Mr. Guaido was declared interim president by the democratically elected National Assembly in January and has been recognized by 55 governments worldwide. Under the terms of the agreement, USAID is committed to providing $98 million in development assistance for Venezuelans inside Venezuela. That includes a portion of the funding that was announced at the UN General Assembly and brings USAID's total development assistance for the dire situation inside Venezuela to some $116 million. At the signing ceremony, Administrator Green said that the new funds will build upon our existing support for local human rights defenders, civil society organizations, independent media, and electoral oversight. When circumstances allow, the funding will also support the efforts led by Interim President Guaido's administration to repair a healthcare system that has been utterly destroyed by Maduro's mismanagement and corruption. In addition, these funds will help to deploy agricultural resources once democracy has been restored in Venezuela. Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for Cuba and Venezuela, Carrie Filippetti, said this agreement formalizes the commitment the U.S. has to not just seeing a transition, but in engaging in the hard work of bringing prosperity and democracy back to the people of Venezuela after a transition. It shows that we are here now, we will be there during a transition, and we will continue to be there as a key partner going forward. The Venezuelan people deserve nothing less than the full restoration of their liberty and democracy, said Administrator Green. The road ahead is difficult, but the United States has reliable partners in Interim President Guaido and the National Assembly. to all who continue to bravely fight to recover their country, their freedom, and their dignity. We stand with you, said Administrator Green. And just like you, we will not back down.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.